Müssen wir betrachten, die Tunam Pavanevia, Baishna Baby und Mama. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's December 4th, 2017. Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 27, Understanding Material Nature, Text 16. Evam prachavam rishyasya. Atmanam pratipadyate.
Atmanam pratipadyate.
Sankarasya dravasya.
Sankarasya dravasya.
I'm sorry. Sankarasya dravasya.
Sankarasya dravasya.
Yovastana manugraha.
Yovastana.
Evam.
Evam.
Thus.
Thus.
Pratyamasrishya.
Pratyamasrishya.
After understanding.
Asau.
That person.
That person.
Atmanam.
Atmanam.
His self. Pratipadyate.
Pratipadyate.
Realizes. Sa ahankarasya.
Sa-ahankarasya.
Accepted under false ego. Dravyasya.
Of the situation.
Yaha.
Who?
Avastanam. Resting place. Anugraha. The manifester.
Muted. Unmuted.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. When, by mature understanding, one can realize his individuality, then the situation he accepts under false ego becomes manifest to him. Purport. The Mayavada philosopher's position is that at the ultimate issue, the individual is lost, everything becomes one, and there is no distinction between the knower, the knowable, and knowledge. But by minute analysis, we can see that this is not correct. Individuality is never lost, even when one thinks that the three different principles, namely the knower, the knowable, and knowledge, are amalgamated or merged into one. The very concept that the three merge into one is another form of knowledge. And since the perceiver of knowledge still exists, how can one say that the knower, knowledge, and knowable have become one? The individual soul who is perceiving this knowledge still remains an individual. Both in material existence and in spiritual existence, individuality continues. The only difference is in the quality of the identity. In the material identity, the full... Sorry, I'm not feeling so well. The false ego acts... And because of false identification, one takes things to be different from what they actually are. That is the basic principle of conditional life. Similarly, when the false ego is purified, one takes everything in the right perspective. That is the state of liberation. It is stated in the Ishopanishad that everything belongs to the Lord. Isyavasyam idam sarvam, Ishopanishad Mantra 1. Everything exists on the energy of the Supreme Lord. This is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Because everything is produced of his energy and exists on his energy, the energy is not different from him. But still the Lord declares, I am not there. When one clearly understands one's constitutional position, everything becomes manifest. False egoistic acceptance of things conditions one, whereas acceptance of things as they are makes one liberated. The example given in the previous verse is applicable here. due to absorption of one's identity in his money. When the money is lost, he thinks that he is also lost. But actually, he is not identical with the money, nor does the money belong to him. When the actual situation is revealed, we understand that the money does not belong to any individual person or living entity, nor is it produced by men. Ultimately, the money is the property of the Supreme Lord, and there is no question of it being lost. But as long as one falsely thinks, I am the enjoyer, or I am the Lord, this conception of life continues, and one remains conditioned. As soon as this false ego is eliminated, one is liberated. As confirmed in the Bhagavatam, situation in one's real constitutional position is called mukti, or liberation. When by mature understanding, one can realize his identity, in his individuality, then the situation he accepts under false ego becomes manifest to him. Evam pratyamasrishyajya atmanam pratipadyute sahankarasya dravyasya yo vastanam anugraha. So, Prabhupada's translation says that when we realize our individuality, then we understand our false ego. Then we understand what is wrong. When we realize who we are, that we are spiritual individuals, then we are seeing in the right perspective. And Srila Prabhupada says here, at least twice, that when we understand things in the right perspective, that is liberation. We see things as they are. Just realizing our individuality is what allows us to see things as they are. It's implied, although not stated here exactly, that when we see things as they are, we will act on that knowledge. And Prabhupada talks a lot about seeing that our opulences, our money, is actually the property of the Lord. That would imply, although not explicitly stated, that when we see our money as belonging to the Lord, that we would use that money in the Lord's service. We would then act according to that. We wouldn't stop just at understanding. No, we would apply that understanding. But this interesting idea that as soon as we understand who we are, then we understand things properly, and then we are free from conditions. And of course, when we become free from conditions, we become free from illusion, we become happy. So I'd like to look at this both materially and spiritually, if you can indulge me with your a little bit. Here Prabhupada says that there is individuality both materially and spiritually. He says both in material existence and in spiritual existence, individuality continues. The only difference is in the quality of the identity. I'd like to start with spiritual identity, and then let's move to how we can spiritualize our material identity, just like we can spiritualize our money, which is very, very much related. So all of us want to know who we are. That is a very natural question. One of the first questions a young child asks is who am I? Where did I come from? What's my origin? And there's a lot of money, I mean a lot, millions or billions perhaps, in this search for identity. People, it's become very popular now, this DNA testing, trying to figure out, all right, what's my family origin? What's my genetic origin? People researching their family tree. People taking personality tests. I mean, you see all over social media, absurd personality tests, you know, what Disney character are you? Or something like that, you know, what color hat are you? But the concept of understanding one's identity is so strong. The desire to understand one's identity is so strong that these things proliferate and, as we say, make a lot of money. So our real identity is, in fact, the first thing that Srila Prabhupada said that we should preach about to people. Why? Because as Prabhupada is explaining here, and as Lord Kapiladeva is saying here, it's the key to everything. Now, you can say, well, Urmila, there's other times you say other things are the key to everything. Well, that's a fact. That's a fact. Attentive chanting is the key to everything. Serving the devotees is the key to everything. Just association with the devotees is the key to everything. In fact, you could take one drop of Charanamrita and become perfect. So there we could have many one things that are the key to everything. But at the same time, we can say understanding who we are, our identity, it then opens up everything. It liberates us. So pretty important point. Why? Because identity gives us a sense of what our ideal is, and our sense of what our ideal is gives us a sense of how we should see things and how we should behave. If you say, well, I am a bank teller, I work at the bank, I am a bank teller, that is my identity. Then you say, well, what does an ideal bank teller do? Well, an ideal bank teller counts the money accurately, keeps accurate records, smiles at the customer, locks the drawer as soon as they're away for a minute, doesn't take any money for themselves. You have a whole list of what an ideal bank teller does. And that list, whether it's written or mental or whatever, it changes how we behave. It changes how we see things. It changes how what we see is good or bad, what should be done, what should not be done, what is binding, what is liberating, and so forth. It's all hinged on our identity. Everything. Whenever we're weighing the pros and cons of a situation, whenever we're deciding anything, it all boils down to what is our identity. All right, so Srila Prabhupada said that the first thing we should preach to people, generally speaking, is that you're not this body, that you have a spiritual identity. He asked some devotees what should be the first thing to preach. They said that there's a God. And Prabhupada said, no, the first thing should be that you are not this body. And I had that experience one time in London. I'd been giving a Bhagavatam class, and afterward this woman about my age came up to me and asked if how she could deal with her atheistic husband. And I said that I would be willing to talk to him, and perhaps because of my academic qualifications, he might be willing to speak to me. He was also some academic or doctor or something. Anyway, so he came to see me along with his wife, and I spent the entire time just talking about concrete empirical evidence that we are other than the body. I talked a lot about near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences that were empirically verifiable. And just from that, he decided that, yes, I need to look at something besides just a gross mechanistic idea of reality, just that I am something beyond the body. Now, of course, that I am something beyond the body, that can be understood through logic, that I have a sense of identity, even though my body has radically changed. My body is so completely different from that of an infant. And the other day I saw an expertly animated video of the child in the womb from fertilization to birth. Wow, what a different body. So, at fertilization, our body is just one cell. one cell. And then four cells. And very soon, it differentiates into a heart and a spine, and gradually different. But what a different body. I mean, that body that I had in the womb of my mother on day 7 or day 14 in her womb is so radically different. It's barely recognizable as human. If you just saw a little 7-day embryo, you'd think it was like some little tiny bug or something on your desk. But there I was. It wasn't a different I. And the newborn baby, my body's completely different. It has the same DNA, but it's a completely different body. So we can all understand through logic that I'm not this body. We can also understand I'm not this mind. I know people who, Americans who were staunch members of the Republican Party, and now they hate the Republican Party. And so our minds can change. One can change from being a Christian to a Muslim or whatever. So the mind can change, the body can change, you can have plastic surgery and try to even change your gender and so forth, but still you're the same person. You not really have a different identity. So that we can understand through logic and through experience. But what am I, actually? I never preach to one person and convincing them that they're not that body, and then they said, well, then what body am I? So that's something that it's interesting we have this kind of circle. To understand our real identity can only be done through bhakti. And it's only by understanding our real identity that we actually come to real bhakti. It's only by doing bhakti that we become liberated, and it's only in the state of liberation that we do bhakti. Mamcha yoga vicharina bhakti yogi na sevate sagunan samatichaitam brahma bhuyaya kalpati. So it's only in that state that we're really doing real bhakti, but we get there by bhakti. The ends and the means are the same. So our real identity, we're not going to talk that much today about how to come to our real identity, but our real identity is a manifestation of how we want to love and serve Krishna. And that real identity is, it is our eternal self. It's not something that's imposed upon us by others. Our material identity comes from conditioning of the three modes of material nature, our family, and so forth. But our spiritual identity is a manifestation of our own autonomous choice. It is an identity that is the door to freedom and is the manifestation of our freedom, that we can love God in so many different ways. And the essence of that identity, of course, as Prabhupada explains sort of indirectly in the second paragraph in this purport, is that I am not the enjoyer, I am not the Lord, I am the enjoyed. I am the enjoyed. Of course, it's interesting that Rupa Goswami says that the one of the symptoms of the gaining of our real identity is mamata, that Krishna is mine. And Prabhupada speaks about this principle of Krishna is mine in Akinchana Gotra, that the devotee is without possessions. The devotee is without possessions. And he says the only way to be without possessions is to possess Krishna. There's no other way to be without possessions. So I'm in the process of doing a very slow move, and in the process of doing this move and helping my family here to move. So we are going through possessions, right? We are sorting through possessions. What do we want to take here? And what do we want to take there? What do we want to throw away? What do we want to give away? What do we want to sell? To who do we want to give it away? And so forth. So we had this big garage sale. And although we're keeping the vast majority of our books, we still had hundreds of books for sale. And unfortunately, not that many people bought books. But so there was this one couple that came, and the woman picks up this book that was a gift from my mother that had been in our family for generations. And she picks it up. And as soon as she touched the book, I started to cry. Oh, that was my mother's book. And I remember my mother who passed away in 2002. And I thought how interesting our attachments are to our possessions, you know, that somehow I'd kept this family heirloom that I was now selling for 50 cents. So if we're going to be without possessions, we don't become null and void, but we possess Krishna. You know, if I can have some sentiment for a book, which I found very amusing, my sentiment for a book, it's like, oh, that's amusing. So if we can have some sentiment for a book, some ordinary book, so certainly we can have great sentiment and attachment for Krishna, that we never want to lose Krishna. Anyway, so although we are the enjoyed, and although we are not the Lord, the Lord is the possessor of everything, still we feel we possess Krishna. The I and mine, aham mameti, becomes I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. So in the beginning of bhakti, that is in a very general way and usually in relationship primarily to our spiritual master, that we are thinking, I am a disciple of such and such spiritual master. This is my guru and I am this guru's disciple. And I have dedicated my life to my guru. We take vows of dedication, which hopefully we keep. And hopefully we keep not only the letter, but also the spirit of those vows. And so it starts like that. And it may even start in a very sectarian way, that I'm a member of such and such, you know, sampradaya, and such organization, and such religion. And, you know, often we're sort of transferring our mundane identity to something sort of quasi-spiritual. Like Prabhupada was asked, you know, what's the difference between the Christians converting the Hindus to Christianity and you're converting the Christians to Hinduism? And Prabhupada said, no, we're not doing that. But often immature devotees think like that. They think that we're doing something sectarian. And they don't understand that those are temporary crutches for neophyte devotees, for the Kanista Adhikari. You know, God is only in my temple and so forth and so on. And that doesn't mean that we're not loyal to our own group, but we can be loyal to our group without sectarianism. which is the main thing I want to talk about, actually. So our identity is a manifestation of this, I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. It's like our material identity is, you know, I belong to this family is mine, I belong to this occupation is mine. So in this spiritual identity, it gradually unfolds. Rupa Goswami talks about like the bud and the flower and the fruit of bhakti as it unfolds. So it's something that our spiritual identity gradually manifests. So as soon as we have some sense of our spiritual identity in a general way, then we've said to pass the threshold of liberation. Because as soon as one has that, even in a very general way, I am Krishna's friend, I am Krishna's parent, I am Krishna's beloved, and so forth, then we have really passed this threshold at which we start to see things in the right perspective. And to some extent, such right perspective even operates in the very, very beginning when one says, oh, I am a sadhaka. I am a disciple of this bona fide guru and I've dedicated myself to bhakti. Even at that point, there's some element of liberation. Just as you could say, the very beginning, you know, you have a little bud on the tree and you know that that's going to turn into a mango. You know, it's the start, little teeny tiny little green mango. And you can look at it and say, oh, a mango. You know, this little green thing. Oh, it's a rose. Well, it doesn't look like a rose. It doesn't smell like a rose. But it's a rose. So one can say, even for the very beginner in bhakti, very, very beginner, that some sense that I've dedicated myself to Krishna, Krishna is my religion, is a kind of liberation. And we notice that when you start taking up Krishna consciousness, that we start to see things differently. We start to see things in the right perspective. I think all of us have had this very convincing experience that as soon as we're chanting Hare Krishna and following the process, our vision of reality radically changes. We see things very differently than we had before. All of a sudden we, oh, that's what's happening here. That's what's happening here. So although that can also be understood as liberation and seeing things in the right perspective, then we can also say it's the dawning of our specific identity. You know, instead of a generic identity, well, we're all members of this Sangha, we're all disciples of this guru and so forth, that, oh, Krishna is my friend, Krishna is my child, Krishna is my this. And that there's a huge leap that happens at that time. One could compare it to crossing the threshold into puberty. And then, of course, that continues to unfold into something very specific. So once one comes to bhava and prema, bhava and prema is very specific. It's not just some state of beatitude or ecstasy, but it's a very specific ecstasy. The ecstasy of bhava and prema is predicated on what's called the sthayi bhava. The sthayi bhava is a kind of, stha is related to the English word stay or stable. It's a permanent feeling with the Lord that never goes away. Just like Arjuna has this feeling of friendship with the Lord. When he's overwhelmed by the universal form, he apologizes for his friendship. And he gets more into a mood of reverence, into the Adbhuta Rasa. But his friendship with the Lord never goes away. And even when he's full of this Adbhuta Rasa, he asks the Lord, you know, please show me your original form. And he hasn't lost this feeling of friendship. And this feeling with the Lord is not only just within the five primary and seven secondary rasas, but it's, again, very specific. So just like among the cowherd boys, there are some cowherd boys that insult Krishna and tease Krishna and argue with Krishna. And then there are cowherd boys that are very submissive. And in the same way, there are gopis who get very angry with Krishna. Krishna does some little thing to anger them because he likes to see them angry, actually. And they get very angry and they sustain their anger even after Krishna apologizes in so many ways. They're very petulant. And then there's other gopis who are very conciliatory. And they also get angry with Krishna. It's not that they don't get angry with Krishna. But they very quickly get free of their anger. They very quickly forgive Krishna. And they're much more submissive to Krishna. And although both of these groups of gopis have the view that I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine, one of them has I am Krishna's predominates and the other Krishna is mine predominates. And such differences exist all the way down to the individual level, so that each individual is a combination, just like something on the material level. We have astrology. You know, when people talk about what is your sign in Western astrology, they're particularly looking at the sun sign. In Vedic astrology, they particularly look at the ascendant. But it's not that there's only 12 groups of people in the world. You know, each astrological chart is different from every other's. I think there's, you know, some repetition, so after 23,000 years, there'll be an identical chart to your chart, something like that. I haven't verified that. But the idea is that each individual chart is different. Each of the lines on our hands are different. So everybody has a lifeline, for example, but exactly where it starts and ends and how thick and thin and the branches are all individual. So in our spiritual identity, also, we can be in a general category of, well, this person's a cow and this person's a peacock and this person's a cowherd boy and so forth. But there's individual branches and sub-branches and sub-sub-sub-sub-sub till you come to individuals who are each unique from each other and each have a different flavor of love with Krishna that is permanent. Now, the interesting thing about this is that what does individuality mean? So Prabhupada says here, when we see individuality, when we are individual, then we will see things in the right perspective. We will understand things as they are. The verse says that everything becomes manifest to this person. So I think that beginners in spiritual life have a conception that if you had 10 liberated people in a room and you asked them how they perceived something, they would all have the identical perception, because seeing things as they are, seeing things in the right perspective. There must be one right, and there must be gazillions of wrongs and one right. In fact, we tend to have the idea that conceptions of wrong are due to individuality. Because we're individuals, we all have our different conditioning, and therefore we see things in as many ways as there are individuals, but if we saw things right, we would all see them the same. And such is, of course, the Mayavad idea, which Prabhupada refutes here in a different context. The Mayavad idea is that when we are all liberated, we are free from individuality. Being free from individuality will also be free from subjectivity, and therefore we will also, therefore we will naturally all see things exactly the same way. Well, my dear friends, such is not our Vaishnava philosophy. And even Srila Prabhupada makes the point here that such is just simply illogical. He says, even if the knower, the knowledge, and the knowable become one, in order to know that you've become one, somebody has to be knowing, and immediately you have a somebody who is knowing. What do we mean by individuality? My dear friends, what do we mean by individuality? We mean that we have different tastes. And you know what is meant by different tastes? It means we have a different opinion. I mean, in our mundane individuality, some of us love ice cream and some of us hate it. I mean, take the thing that you love the most, perhaps the food that you love the most. I guarantee you, there's somebody walking around this planet right now who absolutely despises that food. That's what it means to be an individual. We have different tastes. And such is the basis of our spiritual individuality. Our material individuality is I have different tastes for my own sense enjoyment because of the particular combination of the modes under which I am illusioned. But in my Sai Bhav, I have different tastes to satisfy the Lord. And my dear friends, the Lord appreciates and wants, actively desires, an infinite number of ways to be satisfied. He desires that. He loves that. Also refers to Krishna's reciprocation with rasa. Lord Kapiladev says, the Lord appears in whatever form we worship him. This theme, that the Lord appears in whatever way we worship him, runs throughout the literature of the Goswamis. Krishna likes the cowherd boy who's just offering praise and is quiet And Krishna loves the cowherd boy who's argumentative. He loves both of those kinds of relationships. Oh, now here we come to the real issue. If I have my personal taste and my personal opinion, it must be because I think that that's the best. Just like we have some incredulity when someone doesn't like something that we like, you know, like, how can you not like that? How is it possible for someone not to like that? It's wonderful. So, you know, it's the same way spiritually. It's the same way, with one significant difference. Just like Mother Yasoda thought, oh, my little boy is being very naughty. It's not good for him to be naughty. It's my duty as his mother to make sure he's well behaved. I can't let him grow up to be naughty like this. Then he'll become a criminal. He has to be a gentleman. And so she ties him to a grinding mortar, after which he pulls down the Arjuna trees. And when Nandamarg sees this, he's furious with Mother Yasoda. Mother Rohini is furious. They don't agree. Rohini and Nanda, they don't agree that Krishna should have been disciplined by being tied up. They don't agree. You see, in most families it's like that. The father and mother don't agree about everything regarding how the children should be raised. And such difference happens between Nanda and Yasoda. They have different opinions. And it's not just like they're saying, well, I have my opinion, but you have your opinion, and it's all okay. They're strongly opinionated. And such things exist between the gopis. I mean, Rupa Goswami describes some of the ways that Radharani and Chandravali describe each other. I mean, it's pretty harsh. Well, Radharani says that Chandravali, she doesn't know how to satisfy Krishna. She just immediately forgives him. He doesn't like that. And Chandravali says that Radharani doesn't know how to satisfy Krishna. She continues to be angry with him after he's apologized. He doesn't like that. And even like, why are the members of Vrindavan, why are the residents of Vrindavan, why is it that they don't want to leave Vrindavan? They'd rather be in Vrindavan without Krishna. Because they don't feel that they can satisfy Krishna out of Vrindavan. They feel that Krishna's only going to be satisfied there. The whole scene at Kurukshetra is, how can you be happy in Dwarka? You can only be happy in Vrindavan. I mean, the residents in Vrindavan, they're just feeling when Krishna's in Dwarka, he must be just full of misery. Now, if we think about this ontologically, in Tattva, it's absurd to think that the Lord is miserable anywhere. If Krishna only wanted Vrindavan, there wouldn't be a Dwarka, there wouldn't be a Mathura, there wouldn't be Ayodhya, there wouldn't be a Vaikuntha. These places exist because the Lord also wants them. He must want them. He enjoys them. He loves them. Krishna loves being in Dwarka. Krishna loves being in Vaikuntha. And the residents in those places, they're thinking, Krishna is happiest here. This is where he's happiest. Just like Sanatana Goswami explains in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, how the residents of Vaikuntha, they think Lord Vishnu is supreme. Krishna is a manifestation of Vishnu. And sometimes, you know, Vishnu becomes a cowherd boy and kills demons to please his devotees and have some lila. But, you know, then he comes back here. This is his real home. Well, the residents of Vrindavan, oh, sometimes he goes to Mathura, but then he comes back here. This is his real home. In each dham, in each rasa, each person genuinely feels that their way of worshipping Krishna is the best. If they didn't feel that way, they wouldn't be doing it. They're doing it because they're convinced it's the best. They're not just thinking, it's the best for me. They're thinking, this is the best. Sanatana Goswami explains that each of the cowherd boys thinks they're Krishna's favorite. And he says, indeed they are. Now, in this material world, each of us thinking that our way is the best and our group is the best leads to wars and criticism. In the spiritual world, there is simultaneously the utter, total conviction that my way of pleasing Krishna is the best, my dham is the best. and the utter total appreciation of the service of others. And this is a great mystery to us. How can Chandravali and Radharani accuse each other in this way of not really satisfying Krishna and yet appreciate each other also? Right, Sanatana Goswami explains how when Krishna is going to bed at night, Radharani is putting betel nuts in his mouth and Lalita and Chandravali are each massaging his feet. So how is this, that they're all cooperating to serve Krishna and yet at the same time they think, oh, the other they don't know how to satisfy Krishna? Because everyone appreciates everyone else's service. It's explained in the Bhagavatam in the description of the kingdom of God that the birds stop singing just to hear the bees. The flowers that have varieties of color and amazing fragrance, they offer obeisances to Tulsi, who seems to be very plain in color and fragrance. And there's this deep appreciation of other service. There's a deep understanding that Krishna is pleased by variety, that Krishna wants that variety. He wants it. This is why even Radharani wants Krishna to enjoy with the other gopis. The mood of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is that Krishna wants to enjoy with everyone in their own individual way. It's this sense of individuality that causes us to see things in the right perspective, what Srila Prabhupada called unity in diversity. What Srila Prabhupada wanted the leaders of his International Society for Krishna Consciousness to spend some time discussing every year in Mayapur, unity in diversity. We will never attain to this higher realm of individuality and realize our Sthai Bhav if we cannot accept unity in diversity. It will not happen. It's very clear here that understanding our individuality is the key to liberation. But understanding our individuality has to come along with understanding that every other living being is also an individual. It's not that I'm an individual and everyone else is a machine. That's just anamaya consciousness. And the unfortunate thing is we see, even within the sanghas of devotees, a lack of unity and diversity. The way I see things is right, my opinion is the right opinion, everyone else is wrong, and I'm going to smash them to smithereens. Then we never realize our identity, because that's not the basis of spiritual identity. Spiritual identity is my way of loving Krishna and my way of serving Krishna is absolutely the best and satisfies Krishna the best. And the group of people who feel to some extent the way I do, because no one's going to feel exactly the way I do, is the best. And the leader in my group is the best. And each of the billions of groups of gopis and billions of groups of cowherd boys and billions of groups of cows each feel that. And Krishna loves everyone. In fact, although the way I am serving Krishna is the best, I want Krishna to go enjoy with the others, because that will please him. I want Krishna to relish others' service, because it will please him. Krishna Das Kaviraj says when Krishna sees this mood that the gopis have of wanting the others to enjoy with him, he becomes very pleased. Let's look a little bit at our material identity. So this basis of understanding our identity and realizing that everyone is an individual, allowing us to see things in the right perspective, even operates to some extent, to quite a large extent, in fact, when it comes to our material identity, to understanding our place in Varnashram. Chaturvarna Manasra Samguna Karma Vibhagsa. Krishna's created this material identity according to the modes of material nature. So they are a false identity. And we can say, I'm none of these. But part of a sane society is that people act properly according to their false identity. If you're going to have a false identity, at least have the right false identity. In other words, if you're going to play a part on stage, at least play your part on stage. Don't play somebody else's part. So when we play our proper part in this world, even though it's a false identity, what we understand is that Krishna created all these roles in this world. We see these roles in relationship to Him. And then our playing these false roles in this world in relationship to Him can help us to awaken our real identity. And a society where we also appreciate that, okay, the way I like to work is the best, but God appreciates everything, and everything has its place, also creates a kind of unity and diversity. There's been so many attempts at this, at unity and diversity, on the mundane platform. I'd say such striving for unity and diversity is probably the main thing going on among those clamoring for social justice. On the platform of gender, on the platform of race, ethnicity, nationality, religion, and acceptance of unity and diversity. We have not found that their efforts are very successful. The efforts need to be done through the concept of Varna, particularly. If the way we're going to demarcate people is, of course, gender has to do with ashram, putting aside gender, if we're going to demarcate people in terms of nationality and creed and color, those aren't the kind of demarcations that are recommended in the scriptures. The kind of demarcations recommended in the scriptures are by guna and karma. Guna and karma is far more important than the amount of melanin in your skin or the thickness of your lips or the language that you speak. If we actually were to make demarcations according to guna and karma, and people were to engage in their guna and karma according to the principles of Varna Dharma, we would have a world where there was unity in diversity. Because the principles of Varna Dharma is that whatever opulence you enjoy, we talked the other day a little bit about the opulences, that whatever opulences you enjoy are the property of God. And Srila Prabhupada talks about wealth here in this purport. So we can go back. I read a little bit the other day from the book that Rukmini and I are working on livelihood, how we get our wealth, and the six kinds of wealth. I spoke about that the other day as Prabhupada was talking about the opulences. But this concept that when we have our identity according to our varna, and we do that according to principles. I mean, what are the principles? Well, the first principle of Varna Dharma is that you work according to your nature. And your nature is understood by which of the six opulences you want to enjoy and which of the fields of work you want to play with. The other principles of Varna Dharma are that you should be increasing spiritual understanding for others, that you should be giving a lot of your work away in charity, at least to family members. The idea of a single person having a job and using all the wealth themselves is very opposed to the idea of Varna Dharma. That you should have regular religious practices, that you protect the items of your field of work. You protect ideas, or you protect people, you protect natural resources, or you protect the arts. That one should cherish one's kind of wealth that you're producing, the six opulences. That one should work both without egoism and without lethargy, that famous verse in the Bhagavad Gita. That work should be done during the youthful time of life, that the student time of life is a preparation for work, middle age is retiring from work, and old age is preparation for death. That one should be aware of which modes of nature, which we're probably going to call shades of ego, which of the modes of nature is likely to ensnare you in different types of work, and how to work free of the modes of nature. How to have competition within your field in order to produce excellence, how to cooperate between fields, and how to have checks and balances across fields and sustainable prosperity. So these are our principles of Varna. But I want to look to here specifically at the types of wealth, and Prabhupada mentions that in today's purport in regard to understanding our identity. So when it comes to our mundane identity in each of the varnas, so each of the varnas tends to produce a particular kind of wealth, which is then enjoyed by the rest of society. So let's look at what we call the Sudra Varna, which we're going to refer to as the field of artistry. So the Sudra Varna is basically producing everything that is all the beauty in society. It is what creates society to function, but not only to function, but to function in beauty. I mean, even if you think of the garbage collectors, they're making your streets beautiful, yes? If you think of any Sudra occupation, it is involved with functioning, but also with beauty. And it's the Sudra occupations primarily that create rasa in society. So the main wealth that the field of artistry or the Sudra Varna is producing is that of Shri. Splendid beauty, gracefulness, and a very charismatic kind of leadership, which we see in the leaders and in a lot of the entertainment and sports and so forth, fields of that type. All right, then we have for Aishwarya. Aishwarya means money and also rulership, organizational leadership, and luxury. So this is the main product of the Vaishyas, or the field of resources. The Vaishyas are the one taking natural resources and creating that kind of wealth, what we normally think of as wealth, money for the society. So they are the main producers of Aishwarya. Then we have the people in the field of government, or the Kshatriyas. So the main thing that they produce is Yasha. Yasha is fame, but Yasha is fame, unlike Kirti, which is related to Kirtan, where people are just talking about you. Yasha is fame that comes from Dharma. If you do the right thing and you become famous for it. So Yasha is very much connected to the idea of community. You're doing your Dharma, and because you're doing your Dharma, people are praising you. And government, of course, is all about community on a small scale in a town, or even in an apartment building, in a large scale in terms of a country. And Yasha is all about honor, having a sense of community, having a sense of honor, doing the right thing. That is the main thing that is produced in the field of government. The main thing produced in the field of ideas or the Brahminical Varna is, of course, jnana or knowledge and vairagya or renunciation. Then you may say, well, you forgot about virya, which is strength and power and health, is certainly primarily produced by the Vaishyas, those in the field of resources, because they are the main ones producing food and clothing and medicines for the society. But of course, strength is also produced to some extent by those in the government through the military, and strength is also produced somewhat by those in the field of artistry, especially through manual labor and so forth, and strength is also produced somewhat to a lesser extent in the field of ideas, through mental strength, but it's the primary production of those in the field of resources. And Aishwarya is also produced to some extent in the field of government, because Aishwarya has to do with leadership. And the reason you have this kind of crossover is because the Vaishyas are a combination of the modes of passion and ignorance. So you have the Kshatriyas, who are also in passion, and the Shudras, who are also in ignorance. There's some crossover between those fields. When we say impassioned ignorance, we mean that those are the kinds of ego that are most likely to trip up those in those modes. We don't mean that, if you're a Shudra, you're in the mode of ignorance. We mean that if your personality is inclined to Shudra work, you have to be the most careful of ego in its form of ignorance. If you're in the Brahmin field, you have to be most careful of ego in this form of goodness. And, my dear friends, ego is ego is ego on one level. Anyway, so that would be individuality on the material level. And individuality on the material level, as Srila Prabhupada explains, in the second paragraph in this purport here, allows us to understand wealth properly, allows us to see wealth in the right perspective. What to speak of when one attained individuality on the spiritual level. So individuality experience on the spiritual level, and individuality experience as Krishna wants us to do it on the material level, allows us to see everything in the right perspective. We then use everything properly, and we are able to see unity in diversity. This is the goal, the ultimate goal. It's a goal in a peaceful society on earth according to guna and karma, and it's a goal ultimately in the divine abode once we leave this very temporary spot life. So I have 5 minutes. If anybody has questions, comments, corrections, additions, and subtractions.
Okay, I've unmuted everyone. Anyone have questions or comments? Anyone? If nobody's going to jump in, then I can ask a question. Oh, no. I'm going to step aside. It's okay. Go ahead.
I'm not ready yet. Go ahead. Ask your question.
All right. Mataji, absolutely amazing class, although I have to admit towards the end about Varnashram I got lost. It's just too much dense knowledge. But the point you made about how in the spiritual world there's so much diversity in the truth compared to the material world, you've got diverse opinions and that causes conflict. Anyway, it's a brilliant analysis. I still have to admit that I am confused how it works in spiritual life, that if we think that our way of serving the Lord is the best, then how can there possibly not be conflicts?
Well, there are conflicts, but they're loving conflicts. It's not that there aren't conflicts. There are definitely conflicts. Without conflict, there's no story. Without story, there's no lila. If you study under an English professor, one of the first things they'll tell you is the narrative form must have a conflict. And in fact, it's Krishna himself who often creates this conflict. I mean, I don't know if you've read Rupa Goswami's Vidugdha Madhava. We have Vidugdha Madhava Das present with us. I hope Vidugdha Madhava Das has read the Vidugdha Madhava. So Krishna goes, he goes to Chandravali and he says, oh, you know, I've been away from you for so long. I don't know how I manage without you. But somehow my pain of separation from you was relieved because I was with Radha. And she's like, well, then what do you want to be with me for? Go to Radha, goodbye. No, I didn't mean Radha, I meant Dara. I reversed the syllables. You heard the syllables, how did I hear the syllables reversed? You know, and she leaves, and then he has to make this whole plan, and Madhu Mangal brings her back, and then, you know, she comes back, and then what does Krishna say as soon as he sees her again? Oh, my dear Radha, he says to her. And then Madhu Mangal has to explain, oh, actually Krishna meant this. He does it. Krishna creates this conflict. Krishna creates this rivalry. He creates it. He tells Radharani, you know, again, the Vidugdha Madhava. So he tells Radharani, you know, she tells Subal to go get Radharani. While Subal's getting Radharani, Chandravali comes back. Krishna goes off with Chandravali, spends the whole time with Chandravali. Radharani's waiting. Krishna never shows up. Then he shows up later. You know, and he creates this. He creates the problem, which he then solves. And he solves in all these funny ways. He dresses up as a girl. But he creates this rivalry because it's fun. You know, it's like my son Murari loves board games. He has literally a closet full of board games. And twice a week they would have game night with the kids. And one of his kids here is gathering the devotees together, you know, and having this game night. So why do you play games with your family? You know, you're all trying to win, but it's fun. It's fun. There's some of the chivalry rasa. It's fun. You know, when you're, what are those big tennis stars? Venus and Serena Williams, right? So they're sisters. And they compete against each other. Sometimes they're directly, sometimes they're on the same team in doubles, and sometimes they're competing against each other. They're competing against each other. Each of them wants to win. But you know what? They're also happy if the other one wins. So we can have some sense of that in this world. We have some sense of that among people that we love. You know, I might really like cake. You know, maybe I like cake better than apple pie. But maybe on, you know, my sister's birthday, she likes apple pie. So I make apple pie to please her. I might be thinking, wow, apple pie for your birthday? You know, you should have coconut cake. What's this apple pie? But yet I like to make the apple pie to please her. I'm not trying to convince her that she shouldn't like apple pie. I don't try to force a coconut cake on her. So when there's love, even though there's conflict, the conflict is enjoyable. The conflict isn't to prove some superiority. It isn't to smash the other. It isn't to exploit the other. And we have some idea of this in our loving relationships. Some hint of what that's like whenever we have loving relationships with others.
Thank you.
All right, I do have a morning program here with the boys that starts now, so I'm sorry I need to go. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Thank you for your brilliant class. I understand.